and good morning. You are listening to People Rise Up on your non-commercial community radio station, KBOO. My name's Andrew Geller, and I'm so pleased that we were able to wrap up our fall membership drive just a hair early yesterday. For those of you who didn't know, we hit all goals that we wanted, although we'll see about the 7,000 members in a little bit. Thanks to everyone who made a pledge, and a pledge means you're gonna pay it, because otherwise it wasn't worth making. So pay your pledge, and soon. My guest this morning is Charles C. Mann. He has written many books and won many awards. Most recently, he has written 1491, New Revelations About the Americas Before Columbus, of the Americas Before Columbus. He is also a correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly, Science, and Wired, and he primarily covers the intersection between science, technology, and commerce for newspapers and magazines worldwide. Welcome to KBOO's airwaves.
Good to be here.
Well, I really appreciate you being available. I have been intrigued by the title and content of your book since I first glimpsed it about a month back, and it's interesting because I've also spoken with Gavin Menzies, who wrote 1421, slightly different take, but similar concept in that you are both interested in kind of shedding light on very, very long-standing and deeply ingrained myths about our continent, the Americas, before Columbus. So you tackle an extraordinarily wide range of information in the book, both how did people first get to the Americas, where we're going to start our conversation, but you also talk about much more recent history up through, you know, the just early colonial times in what's now the United States. So let's go back as far back as we think we can and take a look at how it is people came to North America originally, and just for starters, I'll let folks know that the entire notion of the Clovis culture down in what's now New Mexico as being sort of the first evidence of habitation in the Americas is false. So, Charles, why don't you bring us back as far as you feel comfortable in talking about with any sort of certainty about what we know?
Well, the situation is incredibly confusing, and the reason is that the old ideas have been pretty forcefully attacked, but there's no new clear versions of history that are now generally adhered to. So basically, we were all taught in school that Indians walked across the Bering Straits 12,000 years ago. This is at the end of the Ice Age, and so much water had gone into the giant ice sheets that covered the northern part of the continents that the sea levels declined and shallow areas were exposed to the air, and so that way you could walk over between Siberia and Alaska, right? And that's the basic idea. What they didn't tell you in school is that once they walked across from Alaska, they would have hit 2,500 miles of solid ice. And so the question would be, how did they cross that? I mean, even now, to cross something like that would be the subject of a National Geographic special. You know, you'd need special equipment. It would be an extraordinary effort. And the conventional explanation was that there was this magic moment when the ice started to melt and the Bering Straits wasn't yet covered over with water, when you could scoot across the Bering Straits and the two big ice sheets that were covering North America would have separated from each other, kind of like Noah in the Red Sea, and they would have been able to shoot through this ice-free corridor. And meanwhile, herds of animals, you know, provide something to eat, would have wandered up from the south and met the Paleo-Indians, as they were called, who would then have followed them down to the south. And this is sometimes derisively called the follow the reindeer hypothesis. Mm-hmm. And what happened is there's been a bunch of attacks on this. The first is, and to my mind, the most significant, is that it's been very, very difficult for geologists to find any evidence that this ice-free corridor existed at the right time, still less that anybody ever, you know, walked through it. But then, for the archaeologists, probably the most significant finding has been that near Tierra del Fuego, way, way, way down south, just at about the time that people were supposedly walking across the Bering Straits, was a village of Paleo-Indians. This was found established in the late 1990s. So in addition to all the stuff I told you before, they would then had to scoot down, race down to the tip of South America. And that seems, you know, a further stretch. And then the third thing is that all the genetic evidence that I'm aware of says pretty strongly that the populations of North American Indians and South American Indians as well separated from the parent stock in Asia, you know, something on the order of 25,000 years ago, maybe even 35,000 years ago. Then finally, the linguistic evidence also says that these languages seem to have diverged from Asian languages, you know, again, something on the order of 30,000 years ago.
Okay, so if the idea that folks were able to get across the Bering Land Bridge, which we do know happened,
But then the idea is that they wouldn't have been able to cross the ice.
Right.
And so then the idea is, well, maybe they went by boat. Well, and that makes a lot of sense, because there's the Japanese Current, where, you know, which folks on the West Coast know about, and that's the sort of the Pacific equivalent of the Gulf Stream. It warms things up there. And there is these, along the coast, there is what they call these refugia, which are little pockets of somewhat warmer areas, and they could have kind of island-hopped down these refugia. But once you start saying, well, maybe they were using boats, then you don't need the land bridge, because the Bering Straits isn't really that long. It's only 50 miles, or 50 or so miles, you know, across. And on a good day, you can actually see across it. And the point then is, if people could get to Australia by boat, which is how the Aboriginal population of Australia got there, why couldn't they have come across the Bering Straits anytime they wanted to by boat?
Now, what time frame are we talking about with boats?
Well, with boats, you know, people have been in boats for thousands of years, thousands and tens of thousands of years. I mean, Australia was settled, you know, somewhere between 50,000 and 30,000 years ago by boat. So you're talking about a population that could have come here as early as 50,000 years ago. There's no evidence for this. The genetic evidence, which I think is pretty strong, suggests 25 to 35,000 years ago. But again, no archaeological evidence of anybody that old, or anyway, no universally accepted archaeological evidence of anything that old.
Well, in a way, the way a lot of this stuff works is you have to put yet at the end of a lot of statements because it's unclear.
It's unclear. So I think what I try to say in my book is that most archaeologists accept that the kind of conventional storybook picture that we're still taught in high school isn't correct, but they don't really know what is correct.
Right. Well, that's part of what makes it exciting, right?
Right. You know, it is. It's part of why it's an interesting field. And there's continuous research to try and find out what the answer is. But it seems likely at this point that if you lined up all the archaeologists who study this and put them in a room, most of them would tell you that the Americas were settled a lot longer ago than previously thought.
And now, one of the fascinating things that I read in your book, 1491, is that the notion of the Americas as the New World and as being kind of this, you know, unspoiled wilderness, and the native people here sort of basking in almost like a Rockwell painting of their existence is wholly false. And if I'm correct in your interpretation, it's sort of an insult to the natives' intelligence, given what we know they were able to do thousands of years ago.
Well, it does sound weird to say, okay, people were here for thousands and thousands of years, and the story is implicitly that these folks, unlike anybody in Asia, Africa, or Europe, or any other part of the world, had very, very little impact on their environment and didn't shape the environment to their ends, which is sort of like saying that they weren't exactly human. Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful historian named Eric Wolf who calls this idea that these are people without history. You know, they didn't change anything. Change is history, so they're people without history. And I guess I would say that this seems just implausible on its face. You know, human beings are a busy species. We do stuff. And to imagine that people lived here for 30,000 years without exerting a significant impact on their environment seems just to fly in the face of everything else you learned about human beings.
Well, and additionally, they obviously had the skill and intelligence to be able to get to where they were, but once they got there, they somehow lost their ability to, you know, cope in their environment?
to change the environment to suit themselves. It just doesn't make much sense. And then you say an additional evidence in favor of this idea is that evidence has been mounting that the population of the Americas at the time that Columbus landed was much, much higher than previously thought. There's a whole lot of evidence from different lines in this regard. But the point is that if you start having large societies, large-scale societies of millions of people, these things need to have a significant infrastructure to support themselves. And the way you get that is by modifying the environment. There's just no such thing as a hunter. There's never been a hunter-gatherer society of millions and millions of people, right?
Right. Now, you reference native population at the time of Columbus's getting lost and hitting North America. I want to come back to that in a little bit because that's another kind of large debate that is potentially more widely known than some of the other information in your book. But I wanted to find out a little bit more about what there's good evidence for pre-Clovis, which is about 12,000 years ago, and not necessarily North America, but South America, because you reference a place called Norte Chico, which you describe as America's first urban complex, although I guess that's actually not quite as old as the Clovis.
Right,
looking
right.
At my notes.
The Clovis societies are they're originally sort of identified in Clovis, New Mexico, but there's similar groups of people, evidence of their existence have been discovered all over the United States in many, many places. And they're identified by this technology of theirs, this particular kind of spear point. And what's interesting is that the evidence of the oldest peoples in South America and Mesoamerica aren't Clovis people, but in entirely different kinds of societies whatsoever, which at least suggests to me that by 12,000 years ago, people had lived here long enough that they had split into many, many different types of cultures already by 12,000 years ago, which, again, is further evidence, at least I think so, that people have been here longer than that.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's not hard proof, but which is hard to come by in this, but most of the arrows seem to be pointing in the same direction.
I just want to share a little quote here regarding the time frame in which we're talking. This closes out Very Old Bones, a chapter in the book. Quote, given that the Ice Age made Europe north of the Loire Valley uninhabitable until some 18,000 years ago, the Western Hemisphere should perhaps no longer be described as the New World. Britain was empty until about 12,500 BC because it was still covered by glaciers. If Monteverde is correct, as most believe, people were thriving from Alaska to Chile while much of Northern Europe was still empty of mankind and its works. And that supported many other places in the book. And, that's new information to me. I kind of got the same sort of basic origins of peoples in the Americas schooling that most other kids did who didn't focus in the field. So that's all.
Yeah, it's
all really fascinating.
Well, for me, after I graduated from college, I wanted to travel, and so I ended up living in Europe for a couple of years. And I lived in Rome. And I remember going around the Italian countryside, and you would see these landscapes, and I would think, wow, people have lived here for thousands and thousands of years. And you could feel this sort of aura of the past hanging over these landscapes that have been shaped by people. And I would think, gee, isn't it too bad that Americans, we don't have this sort of sense of the past? And the answer is, we actually do. Our landscapes are just as inhabited, just as full of history. It's just that we don't know it.
Another thing that you sort of debunk regarding the time frame of the, the Clovis and early is the, and I don't want to spend a whole lot of time here because there's more important stuff, I think, to talk about, but the notion of the large mammal die-off being caused by the early inhabitants of the Americas. You referenced the existence, as I knew, of mastodon, dire wolves, saber-toothed cats. I didn't know there were rhinoceros here.
Oh yeah, there's what we're talking about is that something on the order of 13,000-14,000 years ago, there was a huge die-off. It's called the Pleistocene extinctions, in which I think it was 32 genuses, or genera as we properly call them, of mammals disappeared. Most of the large mammals in the Americas disappeared in a relatively short time, as well as a bunch of small things, you know, like shellfish and some species of plants. And they all, it completely changed the American landscape to have all these large species gone. And there were camels, there were horses, there were these giant armadillos, there were sloths. There was two types of tigers, I think. It was really wild, and they're all gone. And so there is this theory, which is very intellectually attractive, that because this happened at roughly the time that the Clovis people emerged, it was thought, it was thought that what happened was that Indians came here, they walked through this ice-free corridor I was mentioning, and then they sort of radiated out, and there's a whole hemisphere full of mammals that had never seen humankind before. It was a whole hemisphere full of breakfast, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the Indians just came, and there was this orgy of slaughter, and in a few hundred years, they wiped out the continent. And there's a lot of people who objected to this, not least, of course, being Indians themselves, who don't like this image of themselves as, you know, humankind's, you know, greatest ecological villains.
Mm-hmm.
But the most significant evidence against it, to my way of thinking, is that if people were here for thousands and thousands of years before this, it's a little bit puzzling as to why they would suddenly wipe out all these animals that they had, you know, previously lived with fairly decently for 10,000 years.
Right, right.
And also, there is the evidence that other species that presumably wouldn't have been as interested in people wouldn't have been as interested in also vanished at the same time. So this is still an area of you know, big fights. But I think most of the people who study the subject professionally, you know, archaeologists and anthropologists and zoologists and so forth, tend to be leaning against the idea that they were wiped out by people.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO in Portland. My guest is Charles C. Mann. His most recent book is 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus. And we've been talking about some about ideas connected to how people first came to the Americas and some of the early experience of them. Let's shift forward many thousands of years in only the way you can do in radio. And let's look at the Inca, because you have a large section about them that kind of opens the book's part about South America. And then we'll come back north to talk about kind of more recent colonial history in what's now the U.S. The Inca were really fascinating. And the first thing that I learned about this is that it's supposed to be spelled I-N-K-A, because I-N-C-A is the Spanish conquistador spelling. So everybody remember, it's spelled with a K, according to, well, I guess they didn't write English, but the C is obviously incorrect.
Well, it's not so much that. It's that that was the Spanish, actually the original Spanish spelling was Y-N-G-A, and they changed it to I-N-C-A. And there's a bunch of linguists who got together and said, look, we've got to, you know, make this all regular and make it more logical and closer to the way it's actually pronounced. And they changed it to I-N-K-A about 10, 15 years ago.
Oh, okay. Another thing that really struck me in reading about the first encounters between the Native Americans and explorers from Europe is that the Europeans, it seems, understood that the natives were technologically advanced in significant ways compared to the Europeans. And that's not something that really gets widely discussed.
Yeah, they couldn't afford to have some of the kind of misconceptions that we do. But if you think about it, somebody like Pizarro comes in. Hernando Pizarro is the guy who led the force that conquered the Inca Empire. And they looked around and they saw this large, organized state with the world's biggest highway system, a state that stretched the equivalent from Stockholm to Cairo. And they understood that these were not you know, simple people. These were not, you know, patsies. And if you read their accounts, they adopted a bunch of Inca technologies as quickly as they could, and you know, tried to use them as well as they could in their process of conquering the empire. One of the most funny things that I read was there's a number of, you know, letters and accounts back from the Spanish to you know, various people in Spain, and they would talk about these things like suspension bridges, which didn't exist in Europe at the time, and they would say there are these bridges that you can walk across even though there's no pillars holding them up.
Right.
And, you know, we thought it was magic, but somehow it works. You know, this kind of thing. And then there's other technologies they didn't really understand. The Inca used metallurgy in a completely different way than Europeans did. They didn't use it to make tools so much as these incredibly elaborate and quite beautiful ornaments, and developed techniques of making alloys that were unknown in Europe at the time. Again, was it just a technology that was used for completely different...
Are you still there, Charles?
Yes.
Okay, there was a little buzz there.
Sorry about that.
Completely different uses than what they had back in Europe.
Yeah.
Fiber was another... sort of base technology that was applied very differently in the Americas compared to Europe, and specifically by the Inca. Can you tell us a little bit about their unique use of fibers?
Sure. The textile technology is a much more sophisticated technology than most people of European descent realize, and can be used for all kinds of purposes, ranging from weapons, you know, which, for example, the sling or the bola, which were, you know, chief Inca weapons, are incredibly dangerous, fearsome things, and they would have these massed onslaughts of slings, which would send, you know, one-pound projectiles, you know, at well in excess of 100 miles an hour, and they could knock a man right off a horse with this thing, or kill a horse with a single blow. So these are, you know, very powerful, especially compared to 16th-century rifles.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing was that by pillowing, you can make very strong, lightweight armor with textiles that was far better, at least the Spaniards thought so, than their own armor. And so one of the things that they did was they threw away their own steel armor and used Inca armor instead during the wars.
Now,
the
armor was the next thing I wanted to talk about. Can you just explain pillowing? Because I don't have a clear picture of what that means.
Well, what you're trying to do is you have multiple layers in there. And it's just like air is, you know, as useful as an insulation. Air can also be compressed, and these things, the bad part about steel armor is if it's hit by, say, a one-pound object traveling in excess of 100 miles an hour, it makes a huge dent in it, and then it'll absorb the shock, but when the dent comes in, it'll essentially transmit it directly to your body, and then it can't be straightened easily.
Right, I was going to say, if it's...
fabric is it's much more able to catch and deflect the blow, so you'll still have the same bruise that you would get, then you're not bound by this huge dented thing that's hanging on your body. Also, it's incredibly hot. I don't know if you've ever worn chainmail or something, but it's unbelievably hot and heavy.
And heavy, yeah.
And obviously something that's fabric is going to be... You know, it's very similar. I don't know if you've ever seen Japanese armor.
I don't think so.
Japanese armor at the same time was also based on textiles. And it was pretty impressive stuff.
Well, and the European explorers went from, you know, a marginally temperate to, I suppose, potentially subarctic, or not subarctic, but, you know, like, well, maybe it's like subarctic tundra up north, to a tropical climate. So,
right.
So there was a different need to stay warm as opposed to cool.
Mm-hmm. And also with fabric, as you know from, you know, walking around yourself in the Northwest, you can take layers of it.
Mm-hmm.
So by layering, you could both dress yourself and protect yourself in a way that was much more difficult with armor. Now, the armor was mainly useful against swords, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you weren't dealing so much with people who were trying to get against modern rifles or anything, which it wouldn't have done anything against. And so, if you're trying to catch a blade and deflect the blade, you know, a big pillowy layer of fabric will do almost as much for you as a piece of steel. So there's multiple reasons why the Spaniards threw away their own armor.
Yeah, and you also write that they got rid of their own footwear.
Oh, yeah. that was in an up here. Basically, Indian moccasins are much more comfortable than these sort of clumsy European shoes at the time. And the Indian, colonial accounts are full of, you know, stories about how so-and-so would go out with the Indians, and after 2 or 3 days of walking in the and these sort of crude shoes worn by the Europeans had caused these tremendous blisters, the Indians would take pity on the locals and give them some moccasins that would, you know, fit them much better and be much more comfortable and much more suited to walking around.
Now, you write early on in the book, and this is not a quote, but it's sort of a paraphrase of an idea, that the native people, when first being visited by Europeans in the 15th and 16th centuries, the native people were reasonably successful at, you know, setting boundaries, either not letting them land, or if they allowed them to land, you know, make it clear there was a distinct time limit on their ability to stay on land, and then it's kind of like, all right, move along. Which is also not, you know, it kind of challenges the notion of, you know, the native people being happy to see the Europeans and being willing to, not that they weren't willing to help, because they were in instances, but it, you know, it's not to the point that they were trying to increase their ability to stay. You know, they were definitely seen as very temporary visitors.
Well, you know, if you think about it, this is I think this is a reaction that anybody can understand. And what seems amply documented is that Europeans, for instance, off the East Coast, Europeans first started showing up off the East Coast something like 1480. There was these fishermen, and they would have, you know, off the coast of Maine, right?
Mm-hmm.
And from that point until, you know, roughly the Pilgrims' time, roughly 1620, which is, you know, 150 years or so, there is no large-scale settlement in the Northeast. There's isolated little places where various Europeans are allowed to have little tiny, redoubts, but there's and trading stations, but there's no, you know, large-scale settlement, and all large-scale settlement efforts are rebuffed by the Indians. And you know, people like Champlain come down the coast looking for a place to start a colony, and there's just too many people there. They look and they say, gee, this is just, we can't do this. There's too many people here. Or, you know, there's lots and lots of visitors by traders, and the traders come. They're allowed to stay for a couple weeks. And then, you know, they're gently reminded that it's time to leave. Say, you know, a couple hundred Indian soldiers show up and start doing military exercises. You know, that kind of gentle hint.
Mm-hmm.
And the colonial accounts are just replete with this sort of thing, saying that the, by and large, Indians tried to manage the European presence. They wanted to deal with some of the trade goods. And from their point of view, you know, these furs just simply weren't that valuable. They had a lot of them. And they're old blankets, and they were happy to get in return for them, you know, goods that they didn't have their own. I mean, that's what trade is about. But they didn't want the traders.
Right. Now, let's, as we're kind of moving a little forward in time and I guess a little more northward in geography, sort of in the wandering way this show sometimes does, let's look at how those initial French and other European fisher folk off North America sort of unknowingly set the seeds for literally the complete, like almost complete destruction of just about all the native people, really in the entire Americas, although it wasn't. What I'm referring to here is the issue of disease that was unwittingly spread, and disease that went up, you know, what's now New England certainly didn't make its way all the way down to South America. The Spanish had their own part in spreading disease throughout South America. But I knew that disease was a huge killer, but I didn't realize that more native people were killed by disease before the Plymouth Rock landing than every means since, which is kind of amazing
very
to
much.
Think about.
It's a staggering story, and it's one of the it's certainly from, you know, in simple demographic terms, it's the worst calamity in human history. something on the order out of one out of every five people on the planet died between roughly 1500 and say 1650. And in a funny way, this is a big trap for native populations that was set up 15,000 years ago with these Pleistocene extinctions. What happened was all of the domesticable, animals that could be domesticated, died. Mm-hmm. And as a result, Native Americans had very, very few domesticated animals. There was llamas and alpacas and things like that in Peru. There are dogs everywhere. And, here and there, there are things like, I think there were some Maya who had some domesticated turkeys. But basically, there just simply weren't domesticated animals, certainly not the kind of panoply of them that was existed in Europe and Asia, cows and sheep and goats. And
right, nothing
and
large.
That. And what happens is that Europeans and Asians, lived with domesticated animals. If you were a poor farmer, which, most Europeans were, you shared your house, you shared your living quarters with, your cows or your sheep or your goats or what have you. And when people live in close proximity with other species, there's the opportunity for the diseases of those species to, what they call, jump the species barrier. And so bovine rinderpest becomes measles, bovine rinderpest cow disease. There's bird flu, which is from ducks, becomes human flu. And most important in this case is camel pox or horse pox becomes smallpox. And so European populations are, beset with these mutated forms of animal diseases. Because Native Americans don't have domesticated animals, and certainly not to the same extent, these kind of diseases simply don't exist in the Americas. And this has two consequences. First, they have no natural immunity, no developed immunity to these epidemic diseases. So when Europeans come to bring them over, they bring their diseases, and they just sweep through these populations, which are completely, have never seen them before. And it's sort of hard to get evidence on this, but there is studies in southern India of what happens when smallpox hits unvaccinated populations. And so there's something like a 40% death toll. Hmm. So a single smallpox epidemic in a highly urban society like the ones in central Mexico will knock out, almost one out of every two people, which is just a staggering thought. It's, that's worse than the Black Death. And the second thing that happens is because they don't have these epidemics, they don't have the kind of cultural practices that Europeans and Asians did to deal with these epidemics. If smallpox erupted in a European town, the sufferers, it's brutal, were quarantined, right? They were put in one place and people just, except for some brave doctors, were just, wouldn't contact them. Whereas in Native American societies, somebody would get sick and, naturally people would come to comfort the afflicted person and to try and do what they could for them. And they would all get sick, and the whole village or the whole town would get sick, and nobody would know what was going on, and so everybody would flee to the next village or the next town and bring the disease with them. And in this way, these epidemics spread like strings of firecrackers exploding from village to village to town, for hundreds of miles, outrunning the Europeans who originally started them.
Right, and their internal trade networks within empires and within large-scale societies, the issue of fleeing an unknown aside, just regular daily life and trade facilitated that travel as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you had, like in the Inca Empire, this tremendous highway network, which was corridors for the disease in exactly the same way that AIDS was initially spread from Africa by the international air traffic. What this led to was this very rapid dissemination of these diseases into completely unprotected populations and just a catastrophic death toll. In the areas we really know, like Central Mexico, where people kept records, there is just epidemic after epidemic after epidemic, and something on the order of 90 or 95% of the people died. And it's a staggering thought. That's just going to have a shattering effect on any society having such a huge death toll.
I've got the map you have of population losses, or the chart population losses in central Mexico, and though it's tough to sometimes make numbers and dates work on air, I'm going to try it because I think some of this is really staggering. 1518, about 25 million people in central Mexico. 30 years later, 75% dead. 23 years after that, 50 more percent dead. 45 years later, 1623, 75% dead again. So from 1518 to 1623, just over a century, 97% of 25 million were dead, basically from disease alone.
And not only did this obviously have just a horrific human impact, you know, just one that we can't even imagine, what it did is it completely changed the character of the human world here, because the societies that are most vulnerable to epidemic diseases are precisely the biggest, the most urban, and the most technologically advanced. And so, you know how, like in books like The Stand, all those Stephen King type books, where you know some disaster happens to society, and it's only the you know remote outsiders who survive. Well, that's kind of what happened. And so, our picture that we get in sort of high school history books of the Indians is of these you know hunter gatherers, these people who you know were kind of marginal people. And to some extent, that's true. It's because all the complex urban societies were blown away by disease.
Yeah, that's something that you quote Russell Thornton, UCLA anthropologist, on explaining just that. The modern mm-hmm. notion of natives was post-pandemic, epidemic. I'm not sure which one it would be.
Post-Holocaust.
Yeah, I mean, it was smallpox, flu, a little bit of plague, some hantavirus, you know, a little bit of everything, but smallpox. Smallpox is written in big red letters across my notes here three separate times because it just got drilled into me that that was really the thing. At least in South, what's now South America and Mexico, was that really true also up north?
Yes, although probably a little bit later. There's a wonderful historian whose work I cite, Elizabeth Fenn, who I think is now at Georgetown, and she wrote this terrific book called Pox Americana, which traces a single pretty well-documented outbreak from that went all the way from Mexico City to the Northwest and in the 1780s and just had a terribly, terribly destructive effect on the American West. And this is the reason that when Lewis and Clark came 25 years later, they thought the West was empty. It's because it was in a sense, but it was not so much empty as emptied, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. No, it makes total sense. So I referenced the figure you have of about 25 million in central Mexico in 1518. In the late 16th century, Spanish explorer Las Casas estimated that 40 million natives were killed between 1492 and 1542, which I did a little bit of math, and that basically works out to the same rate as Jews killed by Nazis in World War II, but for 50 years, not 12.
Right. That's the kind of thing you have to compare it to. Now, obviously, these are very historically different circumstances, and not least because mm-hmm. The Spaniards didn't have a modern germ theory of disease. Right. Neither did the Indians, and so these were epidemics that they didn't really understand. They understood contagion, but they believed that it was, you know, they understood that it was possible for me to give you my disease.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, whether that was actually going to happen, well, that was up to the will of God. And so as a result, you know, they knew that they brought sickness with them, but how, you know, what to make of this, you know, they did not understand. And in fact, there's no evidence that they wanted this kind of extermination, although not for humanitarian reasons. They wanted a source of cheap labor. And this is one of the reasons that they began importing black slaves. All the Indians were gone, and they needed cheap labor, and so they brought in African slaves.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO in Portland. Charles C. Mann is my guest. He's the author of 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus. Let's not go to the how is it that slaves became necessary because of local labor being killed. Folks will get the book and read about it. Let's talk about, and use this as a segue, just what kind of numbers of Native Americans are we talking about when Columbus got here? If Las Casas said 40 million were killed in the 50 years afterward, So that's an absolute minimum, and that would be if everybody had died, which wasn't the case.
Right. Well, this is the kind of thing that historians have been arguing about for a long period of time. You know, forests have been cut down to print the journal articles in which they contest this. But one way to put it is that the kind of general belief was that in the North America, general belief in the 1960s that in North America there were probably something on the order of 900,000 people when at the time of Columbus. And, a few million more in Central America and South America. And now, I don't think anybody believes this figure to be true, or very, very few. And they would say instead that a conservative estimate would probably be something on the order of, 30 to 40 million in the entire hemisphere. And I've seen estimates of up to 200 million. Hmm. And if you, kind of do this crude split the difference kind of approach, you end up with something on the order of 80 to 100 million, which is roughly the population of Europe at the time.
At that time, back in the 16th
yeah.
century? Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty amazing, the idea that, just the notion that population levels could have been equivalent, technology was equivalent in some areas, not so good in others, but better in others, very, very, revealing, and to have it all in one place. It must have taken quite a while to pull all this together. Your bibliography in the back, which is a smaller print than the book itself, is 45 pages by itself.
Oh, boy, that makes the book sound terrible. I mean,
I have to
read the bibliography.
The bibliography is one of the most fascinating parts of many books.
Well, the fact is that, there was an awful lot of stuff that I had to read to pull it together, but it was really fun for me. And the bibliography is really just the things I try to point to it in case you're interested in any particular part of it. You can learn more about it by reading some of the original sources.
Mm-hmm. So let's continue on post-Columbus up north, what's now the U.S. And this was really fascinating. I'm originally from New England, so I got all sorts of European-drenched history regarding the native peoples in New England. And one of the things that I didn't know was the case was that the notion of Plymouth and Plymouth Rock was just some sort of random arbitrary thing that, let me see here, the Prince Charles, is it England?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Prince Charles at the time of England sort of, without paying a lot of attention, decided to let Captain John Smith rename Pawtuxet as Plymouth. Now, this is the Captain John Smith that many people are familiar with in the context of a native, girl named Pocahontas. Can you tell us what you see as the true story of Pocahontas, John Smith, and Plymouth Rock?
John Smith was a really fascinating guy. He was this adventurer. He's always called Captain John Smith. He wasn't actually in any army.
Right.
He was he's a captain in the army of Smith, I guess.
Right.
And he was this sort of short, fat, very hairy guy with a big bristly beard who was incredibly courageous and also incredibly fond of tooting his own horn. And he claimed to have done all these outrageous adventures, some of which may have actually happened. But he did really an amazing guy. And one of the things he did is he was very involved in the creation of the colony at Jamestown, which in Virginia, which is where the whole Pocahontas story comes from. Pocahontas appears to have been her nickname and means in the local Indian language something like little hellion or troublesome child or something. I don't actually, scamp maybe. And she was appears to have been some kind of relative to the to the head of the Powhatan Federation, and John Smith was captured by the Indians and taken to meet the man in charge. And one of the ways that the Europeans and Indians were alike was that they each trying to claim sovereignty over the others. I mean, one of the first things the Europeans would do is they would show up and they'd wave the flag and say, "You are now all Spanish subjects," right?
Right. In the name of, I declare this to be.
Right. And, you know, the Indians who didn't understand Spanish or French or English would look on with some confusion as to what the heck was happening. Well, the same kind of thing happened to John Smith. You know, it appears that the Powhatan said, you know, we're going to make this guy one of our subjects, and so, you know, we're claiming rule over him. And so part of this involved this thing where you, you know, that he spared, where a kind of a ritual of this. And so, and what would happen is that you were supposed to prostrate yourself for it, and the king would demonstrate his power over you, and then you would be saved, and then out of his mercy, he would make you one of his subjects. And there was this kind of, you know, play, if you like. And Smith, not knowing anybody, was spared and sent back, and there's much went on. But afterwards, he actually was one of the first to map the coast of New England, and he got involved with the people who became the Pilgrims, and he tried to sell his expertise, but they said, rather stupidly, oh no, we have your map, we don't need you. Mm-hmm. And with the result is that they had really no idea where to go, and when they landed in Cape Cod, spent a few weeks freezing in November, kind of puttering around looking for a decent harbor, during which time most of the people on board got sick, and a bunch of them eventually died.
Yeah, and right, for folks who don't know, Plymouth is on, I guess it's kind of on, it's in the Bayside.
Yeah.
Right.
It's on the Bayside. It's on the, you know, Cape Cod kind of shoots off into the Atlantic Ocean and then bends up, i.e. north. So there's a, you know, there's a west side, which is on the mainland, if you like, and there's the east side of the Cape Cod Bay, which, you know, is out in the ocean. And Plymouth is on the west side. And it was a thriving Indian village called Patuxet. And then a few years before the Pilgrims came, there was a terrible epidemic, probably set off by some captured, kidnapped French sailors who had shipwrecked on Cape Cod. And about 90% of the population of coastal New England died. And that was the only reason that the Pilgrims were able to set up shop, and the only reason they survived, because after all, they landed, you know, off the coast. They landed on the coast of New England in November with no food. Was they dug up Indian graves and Indian food caches and subsisted on the corn that was there.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all, you know, it's right in the accounts of the Pilgrims themselves. You know, Governor Bradford, who wrote this book now called Of Plymouth Plantation, he describes it. They felt quite guilty about it, actually, and afterwards apologized to the Indians for ripping off their graves.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
I mean, you know, on the whole, given the rather spotty record of subsequent Indian-European relationships, the Pilgrims don't come off too badly.
Hmm. The Pilgrims themselves, like the Pilgrims proper, that particular group,
yeah.
as
that
opposed to what
group.
Followed. Right.
Hmm. They signed a treaty with the local Wampanoag Federation in 1621.
Okay,
and it held for about 50 years, which is, you know, two generations. That's a pretty long time for a treaty to hold.
Yeah, I imagine it would be, considering the record that what's now the United States has regarding treaties especially. So this book was available as of just shy of 2 months ago, which in my mind, and having dealt with many books over the years, I assume you finished the writing of it sometime late last year, early this year, and editing and all that kind of stuff. So what's not in the book that's been going on along these lines? Can you tell us a little bit about kind of ongoing research about your favorite item in the book?
Okay, well, I'll tell you one of my favorite things in the book, and it's something that's really just in the appendix to the book, because I had to I couldn't figure out a place to put it, but the Inca had this, and their predecessors in the highlands of the Andes had this form of communication called the quipu, which is, I'm going to call it a form of writing, although it isn't. It's completely unlike any other form of communication that I know of, and it consists of, a quipu is a string, or a cord, thin cord, with a whole bunch of other strings hanging down from it. And on these other strings, these pendant strings, are a bunch of knots. And these knots are read, quote-unquote read, by running your fingers along the strings. And nobody really knows, you know, much about this. There's about 600 of them that exist today. The Spaniards destroyed most of the rest, and they have never been deciphered. And in fact, for a long time, it was argued that the Inca didn't have any form of, you know, of formal communication like this. And just this summer, just at the in July, came the first tentative identification of some patterns of knots as to what they literally meant. And that was really, really exciting. And it's a peek into a kind of form of communication that's completely unlike anything else in Europe or Asia. So that was very exciting for me.
Interesting. Yeah, I got about 85% of the way through the book and haven't gotten into the appendices yet. But since you referenced one of the appendices, I'd like you to talk a little bit about some of what's in Appendix D, which you call calendar math, but not stick specifically to the calendar because, well, I guess the zero does play into the role of calendars. The zero was invented in the Americas, you say.
Yes, and this is a mathematical zero. And this is actually a fascinating story. Almost all mathematicians agree that zero is the most important invention. I'm not sure if invention or discovery is the right word, but you know what we're talking about, in the history of mathematics. Without zero, you can't get anywhere else. And what's fascinating is that it was invented in Mesoamerica very clearly by about the time of Christ and very probably centuries before that time. And a lot of other cultures had a great deal of difficulty with it. It next emerges in India about 4 or 5 centuries after the birth of Christ. And even in medieval Europe, it was not accepted at all. In fact, the Catholic Church was trying to stamp it out. And it isn't until, I think, Fibonacci in the 13th century is the first sort of official time that it appears. If you were a business person in Italy in the 16th century, you know, very often you kept two sets of books, one in the officially approved Roman numerals and then sort of a bootleg set of books where you could actually add and subtract with zero sort of underneath the table.
And the reason was the Vatican banned zero.
Right. It was thought to be sort of unholy. This whole idea that you could write down nothing, something that was nothing, it was very, very puzzling.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't like it at all. They thought it was like this, smacked of devilry. And so you had in this, but without zero, it's very, very difficult to do any kind of accurate calculations. And with the zero, the Maya were able to do some of the most accurate astronomical observations, of the time. And they very carefully calculated, the orbit of the Earth, the orbit of Venus, and that sort of thing. And they built this incredibly complicated calendar out of it that was more accurate than the European calendars of the day.
And I imagine still would be.
Well, yeah, the European calendars, we've invented leap days and things like that, and we sort of fix things up.
Right.
But what was also interesting is that they had a much grander conception of time than the Europeans did. They had they had an idea that time went on for millions and billions and billions of years, and Europeans very clearly did not. That they, the idea of an infinite time was something that, again, was kind of didn't fit well in with how the Roman Catholic Church then interpreted Christian theology, and so, the idea of an infinite universe was something that the Maya believed in, were comfortable with at a time when it was, quite discouraged in Europe.
So, when the idea of infinity came to Europe or Asia?
Well, that's an excellent question. There's a whole book that's about this kind of thing. It's called Lost Discoveries by a fellow named Dick Teresi, which I would urge your listeners to get a hold of if they're interested in this subject. But infinity is something that kind of crept in, and it was probably not around until the, if I understand the history correctly, which I may not, because this isn't my specialty at all, is it? I don't think it was around until the Arabs, and that would have been something on the order of 1000 AD or thereabouts, where it was pretty clearly in Mesoamerica, 1,200 years before that.
So we're rapidly running out of time here. I'm curious, sort of in concluding, do you anticipate any effort or are efforts underway to incorporate information from 1491 into school curricula?
Well, I should say that one of the things that's been very heartening to me, or two things, is first that a number of professionals in the field, archaeologists, I'm a reporter, I'm reporting on what they found, have written to me or contacted me, say that they're very pleased that, you know, their information is being sort of gathered together and brought before the public this way. And the other side of that has been that quite a few teachers have come to me and said, essentially, you know, I'm going to be altering my lesson plans for this. And so I've spoken to a number of high school classes. So it's a small thing, but at least in this way, a little bit of this really interesting work by all these researchers is making its way into the curricula of America.
And the book is definitely approachable for, I'm not sure how young. I have a teenage nephew that I'm toying with the idea of giving the book to him, but he hasn't had. Do you think it would be good for a kid to read something along the lines of your book before going through high school history, or would it be better to learn the history as it's taught and then take the book and go, okay.
It was probably more fun to say, wow, everything my teacher told me is wrong, but it might be more useful to not have unlearn anything.
Okay, good point.
I would say that a smart high schooler could read the book and tried to be accessible without dumbing it down.
Yeah, I found it very accessible for someone who reads a lot, sort of intellectually interested in complex issues, but no specialty in archaeology, anthropology, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. So, I tried to, whenever a peculiar term would come up, I'd try to flag it and say, this is what it means.
Yeah. Well, congratulations. I'm sure it was quite the relief to actually see the thing published.
Oh, you have no idea.
Yeah, right. Well,
thank you very much
for being on the program today. Charles C. Mann is author of many books, the most recent being 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus. And you can see more about the book and him at charlesmann.org. That's Mann with two N's, and there's links from the People Rise Up website at kboo.fm to there, as well as color maps that you can get that are in the book. Thank you very much, Charles.
You're very welcome.
And we are just about out of time here for People Rise Up this week. Again, I want to thank very much everybody who pledged to KBOO, in particular this here program. We had a highly successful pledge drive on the People Rise Up program, despite the glitches along the way, which I just consider good learning experiences. For those of you who didn't know, we did hit the $90,000 we needed in the door by end of September 30. We hit $175,000 sometime yesterday morning ahead of schedule. Thanks very much. If you have any questions about anything you heard today or any other day on People Rise Up, feel free to send me email, kboo@riseup.net. Regular paper mail can come to KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. I'm going to be gone next week because I need just a little bit of time off. I'll be back in a couple weeks with something else for you.